I'm very happy now to welcome Teresa Davis and Rich Forer. They are with the Interfaith Peace Builders delegation that recently returned from Israel and the West Bank. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So what were you doing in Israel and the West Bank?
We were in Israel and the West Bank primarily to meet with nonviolent opposition groups in both Israel and Palestine, or the West Bank. And we were with a group of people led by Anna Baltzer, who is a Jewish-American woman who spent time in the West Bank with the International Women's Peace Service.
Who's been on this show.
Who has been on this show, indeed. And with Kathy Sultan, who is an American woman as well, who spent many years living in Lebanon and was there, I think, through both Lebanese, Israel-Lebanon wars.
And so you were meeting with people who were basically involved with peace movements on both sides of the conflict.
Well, not totally. We did meet with the ideological settler movement also, who I don't think we could characterize them as being part of the peace movement. They're part of the settlement movement.
Right, okay. So let's talk about the various people you met with.
So we met, as Rich said, with a variety of groups. Both groups involved in active nonviolent resistance and groups that were sort of representative of both Palestinian and Israeli society. I was particularly struck by a woman we met in Sderot, which is on the border with Gaza. It's an Israeli town. And it's been at the center of a lot of the reports of rocket fire coming from Gaza, whether by Hamas or Islamic Jihad, into Israel. This woman's name was Nomika Zion. She lived in an urban kibbutz in Sderot. And she began her presentation to us by talking about the very traumatic experience of living on the border with Gaza, of living under constant rocket fire. But she went on to say to us, I have never felt as safe and as protected by my government as I did when my government signed a ceasefire with Hamas. This was in the summer of 2008. And she said, the moment Israel broke that ceasefire on November 4th, I knew what was coming. And what was coming from her perspective was 24 hours a day, the walls shaking, hearing the bombardment of a civilian population that was only 5 kilometers away. And so through the process of living on this border, she decided that it was important to speak to Gazans. And she said, historically, people in Sderot have had relationships to people in Gaza. They've gone over to Gaza, gone to the beach in Gaza. And so her effort was to sort of reconstruct those relationships through this incredibly hostile relationship. And so through Facebook and phone calls and whatever other methods they have, they've continued talking. This is a group called Other Voice.
So they're not... Is there a wall there separating them, or can they also meet face-to-face?
They cannot meet face-to-face. They have held protests, simultaneous protests, walking along the border next to each other on either side. But I believe there's a fence now. I don't know if it's a full-blown wall, as there is between East Jerusalem and sort of Eastern Israel and the West Bank.
Also, we went to another kibbutz in Sderot, Kibbutz Zikim, I think it was called, and the man we spoke to there said he has never felt so betrayed in his life by his government, and he was absolutely enraged, and he said it was because he basically echoed Nomika from Other Voice, which is that by invading Gaza, Israel exponentially increased the number of rockets that were launched from Gaza that were landing in Sderot. In fact, both places had a rocket land on their property the day before we got there.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
So basically what they were saying, if you were going to sum it up, was fighting leads to more fighting.
Correct.
Precisely.
Gee, that's a new thought.
No. There you have it.
So one of the conversations that you entered into with some of the people and groups with whom you met was, if you're going to protest an occupation, if you're going to try to really do peace activism, how do you do it?
Yes, and one of the interesting questions that was raised for me on this trip was the question of dialogue groups and of how effective dialogue groups are in combating something like an occupation, in which the balance of power is so profoundly skewed towards one side. And we saw that. I mean, we saw the difference between an industrial military Israel and a very agricultural Palestine. And many people within what is called the BDS movement in the West Bank and Gaza
and
around the world, the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, will say these dialogue groups promote the idea that there's an equality of power between Israelis and Palestinians, and that somehow this conflict is primarily due to ancestral, religious, fundamental hatreds that can be overcome through this kind of conversation, rather than due to a much more cut and dry military occupation by one country of another country. I'm not sure what I think about it. We met with Omar Barghouti, who is the head of the Palestinian Academic and Cultural Boycott Campaign, and he voiced this opinion very strongly and very convincingly. But we also met with groups such as Nomikas,
Combatants for Peace,
Kids for Peace, which are engaged in sort of a more dialogue-based approach to conflict resolution. And they were wonderful. And to me, they demonstrated the power of individuals to really overcome the kind of hatreds that can be socialized into a society.
Well, it seems like maybe both of those things are useful right. in their place.
Right. Well, one of the things I got out of the trip was I'm all for dialogue groups. We met with a friend of mine who lives in Ma'ale Adumim, which is an Israeli settlement just outside of Jerusalem. And she was a member of Mayor Kahani's group for 15 years, Kach, Mayor Kahani's group is designated as a terrorist group by both Israel, the European Union, and the United States. And Leah was a member of that group, and she had a transformation during the Second Intifada in the year 2000 after two of her daughters had good friends killed in suicide bomb attacks, two of her daughters in two separate incidents. And she realized that there had to be another way. And so she now is part of Interfaith Encounters, and she has dialogue groups with Palestinians. And there is kind of a paradox in the fact that she does live in an illegal settlement, although she's kind of stuck there. But the thing that she impressed upon me is how important it is to dialogue with the Palestinians rather than not being able to see them, because most Israelis do not see Palestinians. The wall prevents them from seeing the Palestinians. And so for me, dialogue is important because it can change the consciousness of people. On the other hand, what Omar Barghouti was saying, and which I agree with, is if you give the impression that there's a symmetrical relationship, that the problem is because Palestinians and Israelis can't get along, because Palestinians and Israelis always resort to violence, it gives an impression that there's an equal responsibility.
Right.
When in fact, when you have one country with a million times more power, military power,
firepower
than another, and that country has been using a legal system to dispossess the other people and leave them with nothing, that's not a symmetrical relationship. So I would like to say simply to dialogue groups, the dialogue groups are great, but please make it clear that you understand that this is an asymmetrical relationship between one country that is the occupier and another that is the unwitting occupied.
We're talking to Teresa Davis and Rich Forer from Interfaith Peace Builders. You met with somebody who was imprisoned by the Israeli government for protesting.
Yes, we did. We met with Kobi Snitz, who actually heads Boycott From Within, which is the Israeli response to the 2005 Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. And Kobi, I don't know his full history, so I won't pretend to be an expert on him. He's actually an academic who got his PhD here in the United States. And he has been a part of protests against the wall in Bilin, and I think in Nilin as well, all along the border of the West Bank. And he was the first Israeli to be imprisoned for an extended period of time for protesting alongside Palestinians. And he's representative of a very small movement of Israelis who have said, we support the Palestinian Liberation Movement, we support the Palestinian leadership of this movement, and we're not going to impose our standards on that movement. We're going to follow and do what we can to assist a Palestinian-led movement opposing the occupation.
So the what we Americans would call freedom of speech and freedom of protest is not necessarily... Of course, we don't have that here because, as we know, people were taken away for wearing anti-Bush T-shirts during the Bush era, but... Basically, that's a non-freedom of speech situation right. That you were looking at there.
Right. Also, we went to Bir Zeit University in Ramallah, which is a very nice university, and it has high standards, I think. And it became clear to us, well, we were told that 10% of the student body of that university are in detention. In other words, they've been taken by the police, by Israeli police, and put in detention. Now, when you're in detention... There's no charge. You haven't been charged with anything. And Israel, by Israeli law, can keep you in detention for 6 months without charging you. But what Israel often will do is they'll keep you in prison, and then just before the end of the 6 months, they'll renew the detention. And we met with someone, I can't remember his name, who was in prison for 7 years without ever being charged. Israel just kept renewing their order. And one of the things we learned at Bir Zeit is that... I don't know if illegal is the word, but Israel prohibits that university from having any organizations. So if you have an organization that speaks up for Palestinian rights, Israel may come and just arrest you and put you in detention. And theoretically, it can be any group. And I asked one of the people, I said, so in other words, if there was a group here that was studying Hebrew and Jewish history, theoretically, because it's a group, an organization, that the members could be arrested and put in detention? And the answer is yes.
I think it's also important to say that this is a dynamic that has affected Israeli universities as well. And recently, there's been a huge backlash against professors who call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. There was a professor who received a death threat, and there's actually a bill in the Knesset making it illegal to call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the state of Israel.
A bill that hasn't been passed yet.
It has not yet been passed, but it's being considered.
Now, Teresa, both of you are Jewish. You went there with your grandmother, who was a Holocaust refugee, who left Europe in the late 1930s.
I did. We decided to go on this trip together for various reasons, particularly because it had been a topic we discussed and disagreed about frequently. And she has always felt very strongly that Israel is necessary, that Israel is legitimate, that it is the homeland of the Jewish people. And I think she still believes that. For her, this trip was very shocking, not only because of the experience of what the occupation has become and the militarization of Israeli society, but also because of her, I think, very surprising identification with Palestinians. And we had one incredible...
As refugees.
And so this happened particularly in Dehesha, which is a refugee camp in Bethlehem, just outside of Jerusalem, where people have been living since 1948. And have been disallowed from returning to their homes, which sometimes are only 10 kilometers away. And we were sitting there listening to a presentation by a woman who had lived through what Palestinians call the Nakba in 1948, the catastrophe, their expulsion. And my grandmother raised her hand and she said, I too am a refugee. And I've had it easier because I am allowed to go back to Czechoslovakia, or to what is now the Czech Republic. But I understand the experience of dispossession and of living one's whole life knowing that one has lost one's home.
Very interesting. Now, you, Rich, for also are Jewish, and at some point in your life, you had a kind of change of heart about
right.
the Israel-Palestinian situation.
Correct. In 2006, in the midst of the war in Lebanon, which I was very gung-ho about, I supported Israel totally. But at some point during that war, I had an argument with a couple friends who did not support the war. And it spurred me to decide, you know what, I really need to investigate this myself, because I realized that most of what I believed had come from one book, Joan Peters' book from time immemorial, which has been deeply debunked, I learned later. But so I decided to start reading, and I started reading books, and I checked the sources. I only read Jewish authors, and I checked whenever I read something that was footnoted, which was a lot, I made sure that the author was, I went and checked that footnote, the source, because I wanted to make sure the author was not taking something out of context or simply lying. And what I learned was so shocking that I experienced a transformation of the heart.
What did you learn?
What I learned is that that the vast majority of Palestinians have always engaged in a nonviolent protest against the Israeli occupation. And what I learned internally, I guess I would say, is that no matter how abhorrent some of the tactics have been in the war on terror, in the fight against Israel from both sides, the people committing these acts of terror, I'm going to speak about the Palestinians. Let's talk for a moment about suicide bombers. When someone has no hope for a future, when they've grown up and seen their parents being humiliated, beaten, called whores, and every day they grow up and see Israeli soldiers occupying their land, and they feel there's no future, eventually a small percentage will resort to violence. I don't agree with the tactic, but most of these people are young, and when they commit suicide bomb attacks, it's the only way they know, no matter how tragic an expression of meeting the need for self-determination and freedom, it's the only way they know to let the world know that they are suffering. And so the antidote is for Israel to make peace with the Palestinians.
Well, and I think one of the very interesting things that you just said is that the vast majority of people protesting are protesting nonviolently.
Correct.
And in fact, as we talked about before we got on the air earlier, is that a lot of these Palestinian people who you met are looking to Martin Luther King and other nonviolent protesters from history and Gandhi.
Gandhi, yeah. Yes, in fact, in the first Intifada in 1987, Israel arrested or deported almost all of the nonviolent leaders, the leaders of the nonviolent movement, including Mubarak Awad, who was a Gandhi disciple, you could say. And at the same time they did that, they collaborated with the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood to create Hamas, and they allowed Sheikh Yassin, the spiritual leader of Hamas, to distribute anti-Jewish hate literature calling for the overthrow of Israel. They allowed him to do what he was doing, but they deported or arrested all of the nonviolent leaders. That tells you something.
Very interesting. We've heard a lot in this country, in our media, about Palestinian houses being demolished. Mohammed Omer was on the show, and his house was demolished with his mother in it. Luckily, she survived, but with a lot of injuries. You had an experience of a house that was slated for demolition. Tell us that, Teresa.
Well, there were several experiences. The first-hand experience we had was with a couple, Teresa, and you'll have to remind me of
Ali.
His name, Ali, in Sahnin, just outside of Nazareth in the Galilee. And their house was slated for demolition because the zoning had been changed for their plot of land because it fell within the sort of buffer zone or the municipal jurisdiction of a settlement. Do you want to add anything to their story?
Well, I want to mention that Ali had met his wife Teresa when Ali was living in Norway. Teresa is a Norwegian. And when they decided to move back to the Middle East, Ali's father gave them an acre of land, which he had owned for a long time. And so they built the house there. Subsequent to their building the house, Israel took land for a Jewish-only settlement. Most of the land they took was private, which is very common. And because of the way they Israel delineated their boundaries, they took a small piece of Ali's land. So that, from the Israeli point of view, that meant because now, after the fact of the house being built, because now some of the land that the house was sitting on was now part of a Jewish settlement, Israel said, part of your land is now part of our Jewish settlement. That can't be. We have to demolish your house. And they issued a demolition order.
And so one thing to say that I was unaware of when I first arrived in Israel and the West Bank is that demolitions don't take place just as a punitive measure against families who've had a family member involved in a suicide attack or in, you know, a violent resistance movement. A lot of the time, they're part of a very calculated strategy which is designed either to make life miserable for Palestinians or, in the case of East Jerusalem in particular, to make life so difficult that Palestinians actually leave a particular area. And this is very well documented. There are groups like the Israeli Coalition Against Home Demolitions who have monitored East Jerusalem and the West Bank and have found that there are very specific zoning laws in East Jerusalem designed to maintain the demographic balance of Jerusalem at around 70% Israeli or Jewish and 30% Palestinian. And so people have had enormous troubles trying to construct their houses with expanding families, and many Palestinians live under threat of demolition order. And having a demolition order doesn't necessarily mean that your house will be demolished the next day, and so you sit and wait, and you don't know if you'll be next.
Yeah. I mean, I was trying to imagine what it was like, and I was just thinking, what if it were my house that I've lived in for 12 years and that I own, and there was continual threat of it being demolished at any moment? Right. It's unimaginable. But we've got just a few minutes left. I know that both of you, having been on this trip to Israel and the West Bank, had real changes in what you might call stereotypical views of Palestinian people, of Arab people.
It was quite surprising for me to realize that even as an educated progressive American, having been to college at the University of Chicago, having Arab friends, I still held these views of the Arab world and of the Muslim world as somehow fundamentally different from my own world. And one of the most interesting things to me is this argument that, for example, nuclear deterrence won't work with a Middle Eastern country because they're too fanatical, they don't care about their families, they'll annihilate Israel or the United States without any sense of self-preservation. And that had never occurred to me as something that was fundamentally wrong.
And your experience was that was incorrect.
And my experience was that was incorrect in both a personal way, in that I met many Palestinians, and they're not fanatical Islamist Jew haters for the most part. They're people who want their land back, which is something I can really sympathize with. And then also, you know, just in the further reading, realizing people like John Mearsheimer will say deterrence worked for years with the crazy communists, with the Bolsheviks, even though we held these same ideas about, you know, the Reds. And so to realize that history of antagonistic foreign policy, of antagonistic relationships to others is being repeated in this situation was very profound for me.
Also, for me, I'd say 90% of my change of heart happened almost 4 years ago, but the other 10% was seeing just how warm the Palestinians were. I felt completely safe anywhere I went. I got lost in the Arab quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. Palestinians came up to me, young men in their 20s, and they were extremely helpful. They sent a kid to lead me to the Jaffa Gate, which is where I was trying to find. And the kid was real nice, and when we got to where we were going, he just turned around and was ready to go. I had to grab him and make him take 10 shekels from me for being so nice. And everywhere I went, every Palestinian I met, I told them right up front, I just naturally felt like telling them that I was Jewish. And I didn't notice the slightest contraction in them or the slightest sense of bigotry whatsoever. And in fact, the most common thing I heard was, it's not about Jews, it's not about Muslims, it's not about Christians, it's about human beings. And we don't want revenge. All we want is to be able to live in peace with our Jewish neighbors.
Teresa Davis and Rich Forer are with the Interfaith Peace Builders delegation that returned just recently from Israel and the West Bank. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the final hour of Good Morning Jazz features the artist of the month, Count Basie. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.